Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
It is time for Movies and Booze. Jean Smolin, Olivia Fahey and Fionnuala Jones join us once again. Good afternoon to you all.
Hi guys.
Hello.
Olivia, Supergirl is pants. That seems to be the general consensus.
Yeah, and she's wondering why Superman is wearing his pants over his trousers as well in it, which I thought was quite funny. But yeah, for me, I was expecting it to be a lot more humorous in tone. It kind of didn't really know what tone it was going for overall. It had like a mix of things that just didn't flow right for me.
Yeah. And Little Brother seems to be a movie that's not wearing any pants at all.
Yeah, pretty much. There's a couple of scenes that you see far too much of Eric Andre than you might want to. But again, tonally, they just didn't really know what they were doing with it. It's like something from, you know, like the late 90s, early noughties, where like the bunch of 16 and 17 year olds would be like, hoo-hoo, we're going to rent this movie on the sly, when it's actually like an 18s movie. Mm. And then they giggle at all of like the really, really like foul, crude, dirty jokes.
Oh, no.
This is that kind of film. So if that's your kind of humour, then you're going to love it. It wasn't really my kind of humour, but yeah. I could appreciate the commitment to the bit.
Okay, fair enough. Yes, okay, fair enough. Yeah, you might be hearing some gruesome it's on Netflix anyway, so it's not no one's going to have to leave the house
if
they want to watch this kind of thing. And so we have a blast in the past and a locally produced wine.
Yes, well, it's a wine from Provence that's made by an Irishman, but I also want to talk a little bit about, I was visiting a vineyard in Gorey in County Wexford on Wednesday, and it was like being in the south of France.
Good day to do it.
I was with two other journalists, John Wilson from the Irish Times and Matt Nugent from The Sun. And all three of us, our Facebook memories came up, and exactly 12 years before we'd actually been in Bordeaux with the late, great Tomas, and we were talking about that. But yes, the second wine is linked to an anti-rationalist art movement first reviewed by Tomas here on Movies and Booze on the 7th of June, 2014.
How do you even know that?
Because
because she's the oracle of
wine. I keep notes about things, and I googled and it came up, so and I actually found his review. But anyway, the reason why I'm reviewing it is it's the data, and he had loved that wine back then, and he said, oh, but the labels are a bit kind of boring. And in fact, this summer they've launched a new special edition label, which I've actually just put up on social media, and it's reflective of the anti-rationalist data art movement.
Yeah,
so as you can see, they're a bit funky and
they were a bit so. But now, like at the time, when that came out, there was just one.
Oh, yeah, there's 9.
And now there's 19 of them.
Yeah.
And what are they doing to them that they're all so different?
Well, they've got like, what's with the percentage of chocolate? They have a percentage of caramel. They have a white Malbec. They have a Sauvignon Blanc. And they have sort of more premium Malbecs. So like this Dada, which is the Dada number one, is a blend of Malbec and Bernarda, which is another grape variety. But look, when Tomas launched this back in 2014, he fell in love with it. It's now the fifth biggest selling wine on the Irish market in 14 years.
Yeah.
Okay, it's gone gangbusters, literally.
Yeah, no,
everybody
it
loves it.
Absolutely. Right, so we'll be and the other one we're going to be talking about is made by...
is Le Grand Palme, and it's actually made by an Irishman who Ray O'Connor, who's a master of wine. And the funny thing is, the day that Ray was made a master of wine, I announced it on News Talk, and he was so chuffed. And here he is. That was in 2020, 7 years later, and now he's making his own wine, Provençal Rosé. So, and I also then just want to talk a little bit about the rise of Irish people, both here and abroad, really making their name in wine.
Your woman Curly, the pharmacist.
But in fact, Jancis Robinson last on the 6th of June featured Irish wine in her column in the Financial Times. That means Irish wine has really arrived.
Okay, if you've made the FT. So influencers aren't going to get to review the Odyssey.
No.
Oh, poor Baba.
Universal is skipping what they call word of mouth screenings, which is essentially like the ones where the influencers go, and obviously they go off and then make
their TikToks or their reels and stuff like that. This is kind of a real bucking of a trend that we've seen, because there usually is a thing where it's like you can have like your influencer screenings and then you have your separate critic screenings. This is just going straight to critics. So Christopher Nolan is like, I don't want the influencers there for whatever reason. I don't know why they've decided to do this. And even in kind of some of the analysis of the, or like even in the reporting of this, it's kind of, there's no real tell as to like why exactly they've decided not to do this. Because look, I know this is an easy story for people to go, let's take the mick out of the influencers. I do get it, but word of mouth is also really beneficial. Is there also an argument to make that The Odyssey doesn't really need the word of mouth because it's Christopher Nolan, he's shot on the big fancy camera, literally every actor ever is in it, probably doesn't need me making a reel about it, respectfully, you know?
Is every movie up until now, anyway, was a standard practice that there would be influencer showings, or was a particular sort, like, you could see Supergirl maybe getting the influencer treatment and then it's all, oh, I saw Supergirl and it's fantastic before the reviewers sink their teeth into it.
Yeah, so like in the reporting of this, they talk about how, like, obviously with studios, it's kind of on a case-by-case basis, and I would imagine around, like, budget as well. I think you can, sometimes when things are, like, less favourably reviewed by the critics, or they're getting a consensus that this might not go down well with the critics, why don't we get a few influencers in to go, to at least be like, I saw it, here I am at the cinema seeing it. So there's kind of a bit of a brand awareness thing. I don't know. Like, it'll be interesting to see if this kind of carries on. But they were looking at how, as I said, there kind of isn't much analysis in terms of like how this could kind of impact the future of it. But I thought this was interesting because I hadn't heard about this. Disney got called out around the time of Mandalorian and Grogu when it came out. They had kind of orchestrated this stunt in which Pedro Pascal like surprised, I'm doing air quotes, a lot of fans at, I think it was Disneyland. And it was presented online as if they were random tourists, but they were like big, they were big creators, which is fair enough. But like when you're kind of positing it as something else, like that's not for this, for kind of clicks and virality, it's a bit weird. Like, you know, like don't do that. But
but if it's like a film based on a, you know, 2,000-year-old or 2,500-year-old orally transmitted ancient Greek poem,
many
influencers go, oh my God, that's my favourite of the ancient Greek poems.
Maybe, No, I mean, there's a lot of influencers doing content around Greek and history and stuff like that. Yeah, that's why I'm like, could you just be a bit savvier around like who you're in? Do you know
what I mean? It sounds like he's going there too thick to appreciate what I've done. implying here.
Also, I should say,
I'm not putting words in his mouth.
And maybe it's also not Christopher Nolan. Maybe it's someone else in Universal. Like, maybe Christopher Nolan loves influencers. And he's like, please come in and do dances in the seats. Yeah. That's what we want. But yeah, we don't know. Just think it's interesting. Maybe one to watch out for. So
now, this story about Hasbro TV this is sinister stuff.
Yeah,
now,
this is a report in Hollywood Reporter and Deadline. There's this UK-based agency, Agents of Young Performers Association, and they've made quite serious allegations against a TV studio in this open letter to the industry that they published, I think it was earlier this week, where they said that they're alleging that child actors are being forced to surrender their voices to be used by generative AI in their contracts. And they're obviously calling this out because, you know, like there's a question around, I think I pulled out one quote from the letter that said, you know, the protection of child performers is core to Hasbro. They're talking about, you know, like children, obviously there's not necessarily a question of informed consent when, you know, like they're taking part in this job, but like what's to say the voice doesn't go on and be used somewhere else, and they don't know that that's what they're giving away in terms of signing it off. Deadline was reporting that it was Hasbro in this instance, which Hasbro is owns the brand Peppa Pig, which is airs in this on Nick Jr. in the States. They've come out and made a statement where they've said, quote, Hasbro is aware of the open letter circulating regarding AI clauses in children's performance contracts. We are not able to comment on specific negotiations or contractual arrangements. The protection of child performers is core to who Hasbro is. It's part of our DNA. As industry standards around AI continue to evolve, we are committed to engaging with this issue in a responsible and transparent manner. But again, like,
it doesn't say they're not doing it.
Exactly. And it is just in the question of children here, like, it is just so weird. Like, AI
But that means if you're a 10-year-old and you sign this contract, they record you and then they can use, AI can use your voice in any context that they see fit forever.
Well, that's what the studio is alleging anyway, exactly. Yeah. As you said. So like this kind of hypothetical example, yeah, their voice saying the Zolly Zebra, I don't know, as you said, and they do that and then their voice is then used to kind of train AI and you could have it training it to you, like the worst kind of example, saying the worst kinds of things.
Yeah.
Might not be as nefarious as that, but it's still like, if you're 10 years old, and again, there's obviously responsibility of parents and stuff like that, but who I would imagine should be oversigning these contracts and stuff, you're not going to understand that. Do you know what I mean?
No, like, of course not.
It's
yeah.
Totally, this is what I'm saying, and when I've been talking about this kind of Pandora's box of AI, especially when it comes to generative AI and the use of children's images and children's likeness and stuff like that, this is like really potentially devastating consequences. And just because we're not necessarily experiencing it now, even though I think we are, look at the weather, that's a conversation for another day, we are going to be feeling we'll probably be feeling the ramifications of this for years, you know, like it's just.
And but some were reporting that it was actually Peppa Pig.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was handing out these contracts.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Peppa Pig.
I know. You think you know someone.
Yeah. And then.
You think you know a girl.
Yeah, Daddy Pig.
Sean, your look of disappointment on your
no,
face.
Yeah.
I mean, it's genuine.
They're a lovely family. And now. But you don't know what's going on behind closed doors, do you?
Oh,
never. No.
That's what I'm saying.
A family of respectable pigs move next door and then it all seems fine. So which drink should we have first, Jane?
I think we'll go with the Grand Palm Rosé, which is a Coteau d'Aix-en-Provence 2025. Now, as I said, Irish wine. There are 40 vineyards in Ireland and I take my hat off to them because they're all madmen. They're not only Irishmen. On Wednesday, as I said, went to Goree in County Wexford to the Field of Dreams, as Arno calls it, Arno Clopin. He first planted in 2011. They're called Peewees. They're German hybrid grapes that have been developed specifically for damp climates. And obviously in Ireland, that's what we mainly grow.
You might want to rethink that one now.
What an amazing achievement for this guy. And it's as good as any vineyard I've seen anywhere in the world. It's meticulously maintained, brilliantly done. And he calls the wine Fada because his wife, Anya, who's Irish, she's been living here for over 30 years. She has a Fada on her name. Mm. And Fada colloquially in the south of France means lunatic, crazy man. So it's serendipitously both. Now, the wines don't come cheap. They're about €45 a bottle. And most Irish wines are in the €40 to €60 price back. And a couple of the, as I say, Janssens Robinson, there's Sean Kieran and Philip Little in County Kilkenny, Colin McCann in County Cork, Thomas Walk in Kinsale, David Dennison in Waterford, whose wines we reviewed actually the first show of the year this year. And then abroad, we have Dermot Sugru, one of the best winemakers in the UK, in Storrington Primary. We have people like Liam and Sinead Cabo in Slovenia, and Jared Maguire, Simon Tyrrell, and Charles Duran, who also featured last Saturday in the Financial Times with Janssens Robinson. So what's happening is there's a movement here that Irish, and Roisin Curley, whom you mentioned earlier. There are a lot of Irish people, both at home and abroad, who are going out, who are now starting to make their name. And the wine from the that we're drinking today is produced by another Irish guy called Ray O'Connor. Now, Ray was born and raised. He started business working in hospitality here, you know, just very, very average. He did the diploma and won the George O'Malley Tasting Cup, and that's usually awards to the person who gets the highest marks in the tasting section of the exam. He then went over, he was working for Gordon Ramsay and Mays as a sommelier, qualified as an MW in 2020. He was working for International Wine Challenge and Naked Wines, and now he's developed his winemaking venture, and this is it, Le Grand Palm, which is a rosé from Coteau d'Aix-en-Provence, and it ticks every box. I mean, these Provençal rosés are very much in demand now. It's a wine style. Whispering Angel is 20 years old this year, and in fact, they had a launch last night up on the top of the posh balcony there in the, what's the hotel?
Alicara.
That's the one. I was invited, but I wasn't able to make it in the end. I had a family commitment I had to go to. But anyway, what this one is a blade from a blend of Grenache, Sansot, Syrah and Roll, all native to the south of France. And I mean, this is a sort of a Whispering Angels type style of wine. What I like about it is there's lots of ripe summer fruit. Have a taste.
It's very fruity.
There's a nice elegance. It's bone dry. It's very well made and elegant. And it, you know, he's another member of the growing band of Irish winemakers that are really making their mark on the global wine world. It's available in O'Brien's Wines. It's pretty new to the market. And I think well done, Ray, and well done to everybody else who's flying the flag for Ireland and making wine.
OK, what movie would you like to talk about first?
Let's
Olivia?
Talk about Supergirl, because I think there's probably more to say about
OK, Supergirl, zooming in after this.
Do you have any information on the brigands?
That sort of information is going to cost you.
I'll tell you what. I'll arm wrestle you for her. Seriously, you win and you can have us both. I win. And you can tell us where the brigands are.
Deal.
Deal.
Right. Okay. So this starts when Supergirl isn't on Earth.
No, this is actually all set off planet. It is a kind of multi-planetary, all within the universe kind of journey where this bad guy called Krem has shot Supergirl.
Can I ask
dog.
A question at this moment? In the Superman movies, she turns up like round the end kind of thing, and the dog is there and she's on Earth there. So in the timeline, is Supergirl, does that precede what you see at the end of Superman, or does it come at the end after what you
so
see in Superman?
My understanding is that this is after the events of Superman.
Okay.
And basically, Kara is kind of going through a very early midlife crisis where she's like not really sure where her place is in the world and all this.
And midlife? She's what?
23.
Yeah.
Girl, I feel ya.
That's a baby.
That's a baby.
Kryptons only live to their mid-40s, apparently.
Early life crisis, shall we say. And so she keeps travelling to these systems with a red star, because then she can actually go get drunk and feel the effects and doesn't have to feel her emotions and things like that. So after one of her boozy trips, she kind of encounters this young girl who is looking for Krem because he killed her family. And Kara's just like, nah, do you know what? I don't want to help you. Oh, but when he shoots Krypto with a poison dart and Krypto needs rescuing, that's when she's going to go on to this revenge mission to try and get the antidote, because Krem has to carry it on him at all times. And that's kind of what your journey is about. And I was terrified this is going to be...
Already this story has so many holes.
Oh, it does. And like, for me, I was like, please don't let this be Marley and me in space. That was kind of my fear. That was my fear going into this. But, you know, I was like, no, they couldn't possibly kill Krypto off. But it is like kind of dicey at times as well. And you're like, no, don't. Like when the little CGI dog looks up at her and is like crying to be like, save me, mommy. You're like, oh my God. And your heart does break. Especially any dog moms out there, you will be crying at some of those scenes.
Is that it? Like, is that the entire film?
That's kind of it for the plot, really. Millie Alcock is playing Supergirl. I have to say, when they announced her as being cast, I was like, yes, I love Supergirl as a character. I loved the series when it was coming out on the CW and Sky. So when she was announced, I was like, yes, this is our girl. This is what we're going for. And she is brilliant in this. She just wasn't really given a lot to kind of like sink her teeth into. Jason Momoa's Lobo is in this as well. And he's almost kind of like a throwaway character, which is annoying because Lobo is actually a really interesting character. He's like an intergalactic bounty hunter and is a bit off the walls, but he's just been kind of like sidelined. He's just kind of there for comic relief at times. The only character that I actually thought was kind of well-rounded was Krem, who's the villain, and played brilliantly by Matthias Schoenaerts. And so when you've got your villain as kind of like your best character, you kind of feel like the hero has lost something in there. The action's great, like, but again, there's like the humor is really, really funny, and again, Krem, like, there's moments where people were just laughing out loud, and that's kind of more of what I wanted from it. This should have been more comedic. It should have been more funny, and it just wasn't. Maybe in my head I was expecting something more along the lines of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Especially
given that it is all intergalactic. That's just not what you get. You get some moments where they're like proper like dramatic scenes, and then you've got all of these like mad action sequences. So the action sequences, they were great, but overall I just kind of felt that like it just, those three kind of vibes just didn't connect properly.
And so the story arc is a is she going from world to world trying to catch this baddie who happens to be carrying the anti-superdog venom antidote with him at all times,
as you do. That is literally it. And, you know, one thing that I do have to commend them for is that they didn't shy away from, you know, reminding people that for her powers, she needs a yellow sun and that also helps her heal and things like that. Now, you can depict that once, twice, say three times max throughout the entirety of a film. But then in between all of those things, they were also mentioning it time and time again. And then there was a lot of kryptonite messaging and references and all this type of stuff. And you're like, we get it. We understand it. You don't need to keep like hammering this into us. We get it now. But maybe they're already kind of like planning for people to be watching this like on like a two screen sort of system, that it's only in the background, so people will need reminding. That's kind of how I felt. And I'm like, I am sitting in the cinema with my phone in a plastic bag. I cannot be double screening this. I get it already.
But sure, if you're going to see Supergirl, you'd probably know that fundamental part of it anyway,
unless you're a parent bringing your child and you're not really as learned in the DC universe as your child is, then I suppose in that sense they might need telling a couple of times. But yeah, a couple of times, not seven.
Yeah. Is it particularly high stakes if she's just really saving her dog?
You take that back. Yes. Yeah. Yes, that is high stakes. I think that more people are probably
going to be
invested.
But he's a super dog. Surely she could bring the dog to a planet with a yellow sun. The dog would get better anyway.
That doesn't work for him. Also, he is too...
Oh, that's convenient.
Obviously,
He's also like too sick. So basically what the venom does is that it's kind of like paralyzing him in the most painful way possible, to the point that then his heart will stop and he will die.
Okay.
Poor dog.
He's in there, yeah. Okay. It's still quite low stakes, though.
I would say more people would probably be like, yes, go save the dog, than go save a kidnapped child.
Yeah.
Like, in this kind of, like, superhero world, I think more people are more invested in saving Crypto because he's such a popular character than if there was another character that she had to go and save that they weren't as invested in.
Yeah. That just says a lot about the other characters, really, if the dog is... Is it a real dog? Is it just a CGI dog?
It's a bit of both. So they do have another dog that they use as kind of like a stand-in just to sort of get a few shots in. And then they do like a digital overlay of Crypto. So
there's not even a real dog, really.
Yeah.
But when you're seven, you don't know that.
Is this really yet another sign that superhero movies have actually run out of plots? And by extension, it's the end of Western civilization as we know it.
I wouldn't say they've run out of plots, mainly because this is actually based on a comic that exists. So there is still a lot of other stories. And the way that Craig Gillespie, I hope I've pronounced that right, the way he kind of approached it is he was asking James Gunn, can I have like a rule book, like a cheap book? And he was just like, no, like this is just your own kind of like standalone thing. You go and do whatever. I think if he'd had a bit of a rule book, that might have helped him a little bit better, because that's kind of where a bit of the disconnect comes from, I think. But there is still a lot of other stories that can be told. And I think we're probably going to see one of them be that done more, like a lot better in Spider-Man Brand New Day. Hopefully, fingers crossed. If it's not good, I think a lot of fans are going to be annoyed. And that's coming out the end of July. But these are the only two superhero movies that we're going to have up until Avengers Doomsday.
Okay. You're making Christmas, that sound like some sort of a cultural wasteland we're living in now.
Well, yeah. There's not as many coming out this year.
But presumably they're going to make like Supergirl 2, 3, 4, 5, 97.
Yeah, well, the Superman Man of Tomorrow is currently shooting, and I would be very surprised if we don't see Supergirl show up in that at some point. I don't think she's going to be like a main character, but I'd be surprised if she doesn't show up. Now, whether he's going to move on to some other stories, like maybe Lobo might get his own spin-off after this, because people are kind of crying out for something like that because he was such a sidelined character in this. But we do know that James Gunn had come out, and Peter Safran, they'd come out with this whole like phase one kind of plan for their new DCU, and they haven't actually released a lot from that. There's been a couple of surprises. So he said, we're not going to greenlight anything until it has a proper script, and until then, like, nothing is actually greenlit. This is just what we're hoping to do, and that's, they've been kind of sticking to that. So I'm actually kind of like, fair play to you. I wish you'd kind of taken a bit more time on the script, though.
Yeah, but they greenlit Supergirl without a proper script. The way she was presented in the end of the Superman movie, and even in is like she's, you know, she's a bit wild and feisty, and she's very anti Clark Kent. Now, is this film a kind of a story arc where she turns into a Clark Kent type person, or is she still getting drunk on, you know, planets with red suns at the end of the film? No spoilers.
Yeah, yes and no. So she does go on like a self-discovery journey, shall we say. And it's not to say that she turns into kind of like a Clark Kent style character, but I think she understands more of where he's coming from by the end of it, as opposed to when she's just off kind of being like, I don't belong anywhere.
Yeah, we get her backstory as well, don't we? There's an origin story as well.
It is. And actually, the way that they do that, I think, is really interesting, because it's a change from what we would know, the story of how Krypton was destroyed. Mm. And this sort of takes on a new layer to it. And I was like, that's kind of interesting, because there's been so many different versions of how it happened, that now this one is taking another turn and another twist. So it was interesting, but again, probably not really necessary.
Okay, right, gosh. Adam McKay wants to kind of get back with Will Ferrell in a creative sense.
I actually just didn't know about this at all. So Adam McKay won an Oscar for The Big Short, has worked on lots of other things. Himself and Will Ferrell had a production company that they founded in 2006 called Gary Sanchez, and they dissolved it in 2019. And at the time, I think Will Ferrell came out and said it was kind of, he called it a bandwidth issue, and basically said that McKay wanted to like scale and keep producing things, but like that kind of wasn't Will Ferrell's bag.
Yeah.
Then at the time, or like a month later, I think McKay did a separate interview with Vanity Fair where he said that Will Ferrell was actually annoyed that McKay had cast John C. Reilly in his series about the Lakers called Winning Time. And that basically, like, Will Ferrell had found, like, it's just like so bitchy. I love it.
Yeah.
That Will Ferrell had found out through John C. Reilly, because John C. Reilly basically rang him to be like, give him the heads up.
Yeah.
And then when they had the conversation about dissolving the company, Adam McKay was kind of like, this is probably the last time we're going to work together. This is like a bit awkward. I obviously should have said something. And now he's kind of going back on that, because he's out. It's the 20th anniversary of Talladega Nights. So he's been doing lots of press around that, which obviously starred Will Ferrell. And he spoke to Business Insider this week, and he was talking about how like he would like to kind of revive their creative partnership, specifically with the idea of, there was talk of doing a Talladega Nights sequel Ricky Bobby coming into like the world of F1, which I'm kind of like, look, I know we bemoan sequels all the time and stuff, but like that actually at least kind of makes sense for the world right now, and I could kind of see it. Now, he's also said as well that like they kind of never went as far as a treatment for it, because obviously it would be very expensive to like do, even like if you look at the like recent official F1 film that cost a bajillion, because God knows the cars and the insurance and everything like that. But he's also kind of said, he was like, oh yeah, I'd like to do it again, but also he was like, forget about what we said in the press the last time, we just fell out because it was like business stuff. And I was like, was it, or like, have you apologised for I love the drama with the boys.
And has Will Ferrell said anything about it?
Will Ferrell hasn't said anything as of yet, but again, I'm kind of like, money talks, you know what I mean? Money fixes friendships and business arrangements.
He's going to be going on a press tour soon for Hawk as well, his new golf series on Netflix. So I wonder, is that going to be a topic that comes up over and over again now?
Put it to him,
Okay. Yeah. Great tea. Right, we have to take a break. You are listening to the Moncrief Show and News Talk. We're going to, after the break, more movies and booze.
Now, this is the Dada number one limited edition, very widely available. You'll have it in Dunn stores, Carry Out, Malloy's Liquor Stores, O'Donovan's in Cork, O'Brien's, Super Value, Tesco, and most independent off licenses. Tomás Clancy first reviewed this in 12 years ago, and he loved the fact that this wine was inspired by the anti-rationalist art movement which developed in Paris during the Great War in 1917. And I found his review from then. I'm going to read it out because it's so brilliant. Just going to show what a wonderful writer and reviewer he was. But at the time, he did mention that the packaging was quite restrained. Well, this summer, Fincus Las Moras, who are the producers of this wine, have launched a limited edition label inspired by Marcel Duchamp, who, according to Tomás, was the artist who exhibited in a urinal in Paris in 1917 under the title Fountain. And his famous painting was that he drew a moustache on the Mona Lisa. So this was like the anti-rational. And this inspired the Dadaism movement. So this wine is a blend of Malbec and Bernarda. And this summer, keep an eye out for the three special labels that are on the wine shelves. each with a distinctive label representing a different universe. They're pretty expressive and fun and a bit wacky, and you know, they're something to have. But I'm just going to finish by reading you the review Tomás gave, missed and loved by us all, and he was such a good wine reviewer. But he said, "The result is a luscious, easy drinking wine, so opulent and exploding with tones of milk chocolate and spice that all doubts about championing the outsider grape are left in the dust. Indulgent, chocolatey, uber-ripe fruit, a delight at a fine price."
There you go.
And, you know, that launched that wine in a big way. And again, the whole data now has arranged the fifth biggest selling wine on the Irish market.
Okay, right. Fair juice to them. Right, so there's not going to be a Ratatouille 2.
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah.
My favourite film, the cinephile that I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not getting one. Brad Bird was the director of the original. Patton Oswalt, who obviously voiced The rat is called Remy. He's not called Ratatouille, okay?
Yeah.
Let's correct the misinformation.
Yeah.
Patton Oswalt did the voice in the original film and he's expressed interest in reprising the character. And Brad Bird said, "Do you know what? No, like we've tried and we did that story and it was great." And even he said there was kind of some, you know, the Pixar executives, sometimes there's kind of like, will we? But every time they've kind of gone, no, which I think is great. People showing restraint in not making sequels.
Sure,
very
but
good.
It's surprising that they would have shown that kind of restraint.
Yeah, because when you look at it, it made like 627 million off the top of my head. I think it was a 200 million budget. You know what I mean? So like, there and like, it's beloved in terms of like Pixar. Like people love Ratatouille. People are very enthusiastic about it. But Brad Bird made the point, which I thought was very apt, where he said, "You know, like it's so funny that people come up and they want these singles and they ask or sequels, I should say, and they ask about these sequels." But he said he always it's about the Iron Giant, which is, I didn't actually realise he directed that as well. And like, that kind of flopped when it released. Like that was, I think they had a 50 million budget for that and made 31.7 million, so like, was a box office failure. Like, retrospectively people are like, it's brilliant and I remember it as a child, incredible piece of filmmaking. But he's like, why, it's nobody liked it at the time and now you're all coming up to me going, do a second one. Do you know what I mean? You didn't even want the first one, you know, you didn't bother going to the cinema to see it. So,
he's not making a Ratatouille with you because he's in a huff.
Maybe, yeah. But I kind of like, dig your heels in, be stubborn, you know? Like, we didn't make it when we were talking about Toy Story a couple of weeks ago or whatever, and I was talking about my rewatching experiences, and they do a whole bit at the end of Toy Story 2 where they do like animated bloopers, which I think should be like a requirement for every animated film. Sorry to the animators. But they did a bit where amongst the bloopers, they had a clip about like the Bugs Life characters being like, "It's our sequel, let's go." And then the lead ant, sorry, can't remember his name, he's like, "Oh, it wasn't our sequel, it's their sequel."
Yeah.
Like, they didn't go near that. And I'm like, good. Like, just some things can be left alone.
Perfect. Absolutely. But you could see that maybe, I can't remember the plot of Ratatouille, but it was amenable to making a sequel to
I'll briefly explain the plot of Ratatouille.
I know it's like a rat that cooks.
Like nepo baby chef who's like terrible at cooking discovers his love of cooking and skill of cooking through a rat, essentially, who operates him as a robot, essentially, via his hair under a chef's hat. Perfect. Brilliant. But how did you do a follow-up story to that? You know what I mean?
I don't know.
Restaurant was shut down because it's full of rats.
You could easily, you know, he buys his own restaurant, you know, you can...
And the restaurant's run by rats again.
Yeah, no, and they have a row. And then he goes off and the restaurant
dissolves. Oh my God, and Remy opens his own restaurant. Yeah,
or there's a rat restaurant or people embrace rats cooking and suddenly it's a huge thing.
Or very similar.
It's the new Nemo.
Yeah.
You need a rat at the door.
Maybe they look at the bear and they say, maybe there's more to life than cooking, and they leave it all behind.
I don't know, this guy should have talked to us.
Yeah,
he'd have been slavering at the mouth for two versions of it. Right.
Truly.
We'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is Little Brother. Here's a clip.
I don't believe it, but I think that's my little brother from a charity thing in high school. Yeah, I barely remember.
Brother? Is that you?
He obviously doesn't have anywhere else to go.
Maybe you can stay with us for a night or two.
What? He's not my actual brother.
Good morning.
But the timing on this could be worse. I start shooting tomorrow.
We should cut. There's a guy pissing all over the car out there. And he shattered the window. And a car drove by and ripped the door off.
Don't mind me. I'm Red's little brother.
Maybe he came back into your life for a reason.
Or maybe there's a stranger sleeping in our house.
What happened to the guy I married who said the only thing that matters is family?
Almost burned the entire house down. Can you imagine?
Right. Okay. It sounds like there's an actual plot here.
Yeah, and actually, yeah. I kind of like the idea behind it. So, Rod, played by John Cena, he had signed up to this Big Brother, Little Brother charity scheme back when he was a kid. And the guy who was his little brother back then basically has tracked him down as an adult and kind of wants to get back into his life. Now, what Rod doesn't realise is that Marcus, played by Eric Andre, has been reaching out to him via email for years, but it's actually been his assistant that's been responding to these emails. So basically Marcus thinks that they have this big like relationship that has been built over years, and Rod is just like, I barely remember this guy. And that's kind of where the dramatic starts. So when you hear in that clip, he's like, oh, that's not my brother, because when he gets a phone call to say your brother's been in an accident, he shows up to the hospital expecting his actual brother, played by Chris Maloney. So when they pull back the curtain and it's Eric Andre sitting there, he's like, no, I've no idea who that person is. And then once he says, like, oh, I'm Marcus, it all kind of comes back to him. And what I found kind of like the really unrealistic...
Does the assistant get fired at that point?
No, she doesn't actually, because there was a protocol that she was to basically be filtering through some of these emails, because he's now like a rich real estate agent and he's like, oh, like people like just keep reaching out all the time, and she basically filters all of that for him. But she was like, oh, but he was so sad and he responded, and like, yeah, okay, I can get it, like taking pity on him kind of thing. So there is like a strong basis, but unfortunately it is just a case of the way that the comedy is portrayed. It's like, yes, you want to have like the straight man versus the crazy guy. That's kind of a very common trope in comedies. But John Cena's version is just so rigid that there's just not actually that much humor left for him to give. And even then, the bits that he tries to do, they just don't land. Whereas Eric Andre is then so far over the hill and far away with the crazy that it's just a complete imbalance. It's almost like they're in two different movies, because the tonal shift is just completely off.
But John Cena can do comedy.
He can. And as many people may remember, I absolutely loved him in Ricky Stenicki when he was a drunken failed actor dressed as Britney Spears. Like, he can do comedy really, really well. But I think he's actually funnier as the kind of more comedic side of things than the straight guy.
Yes, I gotcha. Right, okay. And so, he meets him in hospital and he's had an accident. So what propels other than I don't know this guy, I've never, I can't remember him, and John Cena walks out, what propels the story on
then? So basically, Marcus is injured and he needs a place to stay. So Deirdre, Rod's wife, says, oh, you of course can come stay with us. And that's kind of where the disbelief kind of lands for me, because I'm like, why would you invite a stranger into your home? And then also, like, she opens up to him a lot that night as they're like sharing. She's like, oh, here's all my marriage woes. I'm like, who in their right mind would share some of those details, like what
goes on
in your bed.
But she knows that her husband can't remember this guy.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
And she knows this, and it's a weird one, but that they form like a friendly bond, and he's giving her like marriage advice kind of thing, which some of it that she takes, and leads to some very, very strange sequences. Shall we say?
Okay, let me say, yeah. So, which I suppose is like the nature of the comedy is quite gross.
It is, yeah. So in the clip you heard there was talk about some guy who was peeing all over a car. That was Rudd's car, and he had locked Marcus in there basically because he was gone filming for this reality show about property sales, and Marcus needed to pee. And so he rolled down the window because he couldn't get out of the car, and he was trying to aim it out the car and missed and was getting it in his face and his mouth and all sorts of things, and like commitment to the bit, like fair play to him.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But
Jane is dying to see this.
Yeah, but it's like, but I was kind of like, oh my god, that's so disgusting. There's also a moment in the hospital when he's getting a catheter removed, and you find out in the outtakes that yes, it was a fake penis that they had attached to Andre. But basically,
that's a relief.
The tube coming out of the penis gets whiplash and like splashes everywhere, and that's seen as one of a funny moment. Yeah, everyone is grimacing in the studio, by the way, as I'm telling the story, so you can imagine how I felt watching it.
Wow. Okay. Well, yeah. I'm trying to be fair to it. It's aimed at a particular, very particular demographic.
It really is. So, like, if you were, so, like, I would always say, like, American Pie kind of did this kind of level of humor really, really well. And then there was a bunch of films that followed it that tried to do the same thing but didn't really do it as well. This is kind of one of those films. It's just like two decades later kind of thing.
Yeah.
So while they're trying to kind of recapture a sort of sense of foul comedy, shall we say, like really crudeness. For me, it didn't really land, but I'm sure it will land for other people. It just didn't work for me. I actually said that I'd review this over the new Jackass movie because I thought there'd be more to talk about with it than the Jackass movie. I didn't realize how similar in topics some of these are.
But the Jackass movie is just a greatest hits from the sound of it anyway.
Basically it's kind of like what people are kind of doing on TikTok. It's now been a film for Jackass.
You see, the thing is, I think about that, you know, you talk about American Pie and that was funny then. It's just probably when you're in puberty, it's still funny. But then as soon as you move out of puberty, it's not funny anymore. But it's basically recycling the same jokes over and over
again.
Actually,
that's a really good point. So like I said in the beginning, like if you're like 16, 17 years old and you're like looking for something cheeky to watch that you know you're still probably underage for, this is probably the film that they're going
to
watch.
Okay, so recommend it to the kids, folks. They'll really enjoy it. Finally, good news, there's going to be a Donkey spin-off.
Do you remember, when was it? 4 minutes ago, where I said we could maybe exercise more restraint in doing sequels and spin-offs? Well, Universal Pictures said no, because we are going to get a Donkey spin-off. Donkey from the Shrek universe, of course. Eddie Murphy is back to do the voice that he's done since 2001. It is going to be an origin story. We're going back to far away. How did Donkey get to befriend that woman who then sold him to Shrek? That's like essentially, I think, So this is ahead of the next one, which is coming, I think it's next year, the 2027 one, the Shrek 5, starring Zendaya and all the others and stuff like that. So it never ends. It just never ends.
I don't resent Donkey having his own film, really.
Do you know what? Neither do I. And I will say, as much as I'm saying this so cynically, I know some of the other spin-offs have been like genuinely successful in terms of, like, the Puss in Boots one is always referenced as like just a good film, like separate to the franchise and separate to it being a children's movie. It's something to do with wishes or something. You'd find
the
it
last
if you're
wish.
The Last Wish. Thank you. So like maybe, I don't know. I don't know.
That's a sign of maturity. Yeah. Being able to say, I don't know.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
growth.
We'll leave everybody with that thought. thanks to Jean, Olivia and Fionnuala.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks in at mine.
The martini, shaken not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.